This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents North Korea Undercover, Inside the World's Most Secret State by John Sweeney. This book is read by Gildert Jackson. To the Forgotten of the Gulag. The woman was paper thin, a sign hung from her neck. Selling, my daughter, 100 won. 100 won is roughly 73 US cents, or 47 p. Chan Jing Song, selling my daughter. The leader is the supreme brain of a living body. The party is the nerve of that living body, and the masses are only endowed with life when they offer their absolute loyalty. Juche, the guiding philosophy of the North Korean regime, set out in Kim Jong-il's 10 Principles. Life in the abstract, in its great coach, how nice. But amidst vomit and outrage, the real thing triumphs. It flows, sewage and decay. I suffer moons, hungers, cruel Christs of pus. I give in bone the explanation of this, my misfortune. Pieta, by North Korean Gulag inmate, 1967-74, Ali Lameda. Preface to the American edition. North Korea is mad, bad, and dangerous to mock. Kim Jong-un may appear a fat clown, but when his tyranny bites, its venom, like a cobra's, blackens flesh. In 2013, I went undercover to the dark state for BBC Panorama. Pyongyang feels like the set of some weird version of the Hunger Games. North Korea's go-between kicked up a fuss about our documentary, and to cut a long story short, the BBC apologized, and I ended up losing my job. So, I feel a great sympathy for the makers of The Interview, Seth Rogen and James Franco, who came up with a bold comedy idea about two dumbass American journalists getting an interview with Kim Jong-un. Along comes the CIA, and they're ordered to assassinate Kim. The movie has too many butt jokes, but it is funny and good. There is a show-stopping moment when the hitherto entirely moronic celebrity interviewer asks a simple question of Kim Jong-un, why don't you feed your people? The North Koreans called the interview an act of war. There followed a massive hack of the almighty Sony Picture Corporation. The North Koreans denied hacking Sony, but nevertheless called it a righteous deed. When the film wasn't shelved, a peculiar outfit calling itself the Guardians of Peace made more threats. We will clearly show it to you at the very time and places the interview be shown, including the premiere, how bitter fate those who seek fun in terror should be doomed to. The world will be full of fear. Remember the 11th of September 2001. The idiom is pure North Korglish, hate-speak with clunky English grammar boilerplated in Pyongyang. Despite their denials of being responsible for the hacking, North Korea remains prime suspect. The leaks show how the Japanese boss of the parent company, the Sony Corporation, worked hard to tone down the satire's sting. Kazuo Hirai, the chief executive of Sony proper, instructed Sony Pictures boss Amy Pascal, and she emailed the film's director Rogen to enfeeble the scene which culminates with Kim Jong-un's head exploding. Pascal requested no face melting, less fire in the hair, fewer embers on the face. Rogen replied, "This is now a story of Americans changing their movie to make North Koreans happy." But in time, chunks of the film, including the entire secondary wave of head chunks, were deleted. Then Sony killed the movie, pulling it from release on Christmas Day 2014. The bad news for North Korea was this was widely seen as a cave-in to a mad dictatorship. President Obama diplomatically rebuked Sony, and on Twitter, one wit replaced the famous Hollywood sign with one boasting North Korea. Sony reversed its decision, and the interview was watched in a small number of independently owned picture houses across the states, but by millions more on the internet. Kim Jong-un's minions should have been more wary of the Barbara Streisand effect, that if you try and suppress something in the West, you may end up giving it a far wider publicity. The great virtue of the interview affair is that it has shone a light on the darkest government in the world, and for that, we have reasons to cheer Rogan and Franco. North Korea is a clown state, but it is also evil. The simple aim of this book is to set out to Americans the nature of that evil and how it might be ended. The European who has known North Korea the longest is Isidore Urian, who first went to the newly Stalinized state in 1948. The journey from his native Romania to Pyongyang by train took the best part of 14 days. Isidore ended up being Ceausescu's interpreter when he visited the founder of the state, Kim Il-sung, in the early 70s. On YouTube, you can see Isidore, a real-life zelig, crouching in the back of the massive limousine carrying the two despots when Ceausescu went to Pyongyang. I tracked Isidore, now a very old man in his late 80s, to his home in Bucharest. How long has the regime got? Isidore and I both agreed that Kim Il-sung's grandson, Kim Jong-un, was making a hash of power, openly bloody, reckless, foolish. 40 years? Said Isidore. My take? Kim Jong-un could fall in 40 months. How is that possible in a society whose people know next to nothing about the outside world? For example, the average North Korean doesn't know that the Americans have landed on the moon, that Michael Jackson lived and died, and that Elvis lives again. For the vast majority of people, there is no internet. The regime shoves propaganda down people's throats all the livelong day, telling them they live in the most perfect and most racially pure society in the world. The good news is that I suspect more and more North Koreans are beginning to realize that that claim is a stinking lie. The reason is simple. North Korea's information lockdown is no longer possible in the digital age. Just as the tyranny of Libya fell because people who hated the moronic, Botoxed rule of Muammar Gaddafi realized via the internet and social media that they were not alone, North Koreans are beginning to understand that too. The most powerful moment of optimism I felt in North Korea was the day when we visited the DMZ, the very south of the country, and one of the very bright LSE students I went with, an American, realized that his iPhone would work, piggybacking off the signal from mobile phone masts in the very north of South Korea. If we could do that, then so could a North Korean with a smuggled Chinese-manufactured phone. Likewise, North Koreans who live in the very north of the country can piggyback signals from the very south of China. We met people who had seen Homeland, Mission Impossible, the complexity of explaining Tom Cruise's devotion to the Church of Scientology to a North Korean was beyond me, and even, I suspected, Team America, in which Kim II, Kim Jong-il, sings, "I'm so ronery and sadry arone," while the skeleton of Hans Blix swims in the shark tank, his suitcase full of nuclear secrets still handcuffed to his hand. I sang "I'm So Ronery" in Pyongyang, to myself, very quietly, because I was, am, and always will be confident that the Kim regime is a force for evil in the world, and evil should be challenged, not accommodated. That challenge is all the more difficult because the North Koreans have now exploded 3 nuclear devices below ground. Making a nuclear bomb is one thing, delivering it is quite different. Thus far, the North Koreans have not been able to shrink a nuke so that it can sit on top of one of their rockets. Thus far, their best bit of rocketry has been to fire a missile over the waist of Japan, splashing into the Pacific on the eastern seaboard of that country. That is a very, very long way from Los Angeles. The other thought to bear in mind is that any military challenge to the United States or its ally, South Korea, will be regime suicide. If North Korea dares strike, Kim Jong-un and his merry men will die very quickly. Common sense tells us that threats of nuclear war from Pyongyang are empty bluster, but the hate speak masks a human rights tragedy on an immense scale. The evidence of defectors, which numbers more than 25,000 people, points to the Gulag being as hellish as Nazi concentration camps. That is the clear message from the United Nations Commission of Inquiry into Human Rights Abuses in North Korea. Calls to have Kim Jong-un hauled up in front of the International Criminal Court will be frustrated by China and Russia. The Kremlin is currently happy to back a regime that does not threaten it, but does irritate the West. Beijing is vastly more powerful. If China wanted to crush the Kim tyranny, it could do so very easily. But the ultra-conservative security and military complex that runs China to this day fears an American ally, South Korea, moving up to its borders. So better, in its view, to put up with a tricky and occasionally obnoxious neighbor than have a US proxy there instead. The other regional stakeholders, South Korea, Japan, and the United States, fear any sudden transition from the status quo. War is not an option with an adversary with nuclear weapons tucked away somewhere underground. Stasis is better than a mob armed, not with pikes, but nukes. For the moment, the key to unlocking the poor, wretched people of North Korea from their prison cell state lies in the hands of the Chinese government, and there is little sign of Beijing lifting a finger. On the contrary, there is powerful evidence that the Chinese routinely break international laws they have signed up to and send back refugees from North Korea, causing the victims fresh misery. That picture could change. The Japanese right is pressing the Americans by asking, why should we abjure nuclear weapons if the North Koreans have them? That question causes unease in Beijing. The Stalinist show trial of Kim Jong-un's uncle, Jang Sun-taik, and his execution in 2013, reportedly by being bitten to death by savage dogs, although most likely by the traditional method of 9 grams of lead to the back of the head, conveyed a message to China. Uncle Jung was China's man in Pyongyang, and the message from Kim Jong-un was don't mess with me. For the moment, the subterranean pressures in Beijing favor toleration of the North Korean tyrant. That, too, could change. Regime change in North Korea is most likely to happen when a general, perhaps head of the rocket division, realizes that he may soon die because his toys won't work properly. Rather than accepting his fate, he may realize that killing Kim Jong-un is the better solution. The thing which could easily tilt it is someone powerful in China telling that North Korean general, if you shoot Kim Jong-un, we won't mind. As some point, the regime will get crushed by its own internal contradictions. The land is poor and mountainous, and unless North Korea trades with the rest of the world, it cannot feed its own people. If it trades, people will mix with the outside world and realize that the regime has been telling them a great big lie. The great famine of the late 90s, in which maybe 4 million died out of a population of 20-odd million, was a shearing point. From the famine onwards, people knew in their hearts that the regime could not feed its subjects. I write that, but am continually drawn to the internet. On YouTube, you can watch videos of mass weeping at the death of Kim Jong-il in 2011, a man who presided over the famine. Do they mean it, or are they mucking about? The answer to that is tricky and conflicted. Yes, it seems, many, many millions of North Koreans continue to be brainwashed, and I use that word deliberately, but a much smaller number are beginning to become skeptical. The point is that the skeptics, the people who watch South Korean videos showing the good life, the food, the cars, the clothes that ordinary people in the world's 11th most successful economy enjoy, smuggled in on thumbsticks, are growing in number. We in the West should do more to help that. I believe that my former employer, the BBC, by the way, still a great thing, should broadcast into North Korea as it broadcast into Nazi-occupied Europe during the Second World War. I believe that American broadcasters, such as Voice of America, should boost their output. Charles Robert Jenkins was an American GI who made the long mistake of crossing the DMZ and defecting to North Korea in 1965. One of the best moments of his 40 years in the dungeon state was listening to a dramatization of Mice and Men on Voice of America, beamed from Japan. The West's broadcasters should pump out the work of great organizations like the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, based in Washington, D.C., but also the froth and giddy sillinesses of Western culture in English and in North Korean. They should broadcast Baywatch and Miami Vice and Star Trek from the 1960s. Remember, no North Korean has ever seen these shows. And report the saga of The Interview, warts and all. And show the North Koreans that a society or a company or a culture that can admit that it can get things wrong is far better than one that denies the very possibility of failure. Information is light. And the people of the dark state of North Korea need more of that than anything else. America, use your power to switch on the light. John Sweeney. Introduction. The Air Korea jet floated down to Earth, the ground below treeless, bleak. The plane landed smoothly enough, but then we wobbled down an immensely long and bumpy runway, past banks of earth, sinister watchtowers, and threadbare sprigs of barbed wire, straight out of the spy who came in from the cold. Down the plane's steps, one small leap, and on to North Korean concrete. I thought to myself, what the in Pyongyang we do now? The longer you spend in North Korea, the less fearful you become. Fear is fueled by ignorance. The simple goal of this book is to make the world's most secretive state a little less unknown, to map this terra incognita that loves to tell us, be afraid. It ain't easy. Understanding North Korea is like figuring out a detective story where you stumble across a corpse in the library, a smoking gun beside it, and the corpse gets up and says that's no gun and it isn't smoking and this isn't a library. It is like nowhere else on earth. No ads burble, no traffic dragon roars, no birds sing. Kim Il-sung and his son, Kim Jong-il, smile down at you from a giant diptych hoarding. No one smiles back. Kim Il-sung is Kim the First, but in the regime's iconography, he comes across as an uber-effeminate God the Mother, all mumsy in 1950s, a celestial Doris Day. Kim Jong-il, a.k.a. Kim the Second, is God the Lousy Elvis impersonator, in bouffant hairdo and elevator heels, creepy beyond weird. Kim Jong-un is Fat Boy Kim, threatening thermonuclear war against the United States one day, reportedly having his ex-girlfriend machine-gunned the next. Our frog-green tourist coach kicks into life, and our black-suited minder, Mr. Hyun, breathes into the mic. At the moment, the situation is very tense. Nobody knows when the war will be provoked, but we will be safe. Our bus has the mark of the Korean International Travel Company, so the Americans won't strike our bus. Ha ha. Is the threat of nuclear war real? Has it ever been? Three words. I don't know. What I do know is this. They took us along a vast motorway. There were no cars. They took us to a university. There were no students. They took us to a library. There were no books, at least no books worth reading, and certainly no George Orwell's 1984, I did ask. A bottling plant, no bottles. An electricity-generating machine factory, no electricity. A children's camp, no children. A farm, no animals. A hospital, patients, but only in the morning. Then the lights went out. The dictatorship tells lies about ordinary things. The evidence from our 8 days inside North Korea, when Kim Jong-un's threats of thermonuclear war were at their most frenzied, suggests, how to put this diplomatically, that the regime is full of dross. If North Korea launches a nuclear strike, the regime and everyone in it will die. The working hypothesis of North Korea undercover is that Kim Jong-un's talk of nuclear war is a confidence trick, and that the Pyongyang bluff is blinding us to a human rights tragedy on an immense scale. To make the confidence trick work, the regime keeps everybody, outsiders and its own people, in the dark. Understanding what happens in front of your eyes is beyond strange. You are left wondering at your own grip on reality, like the moment in The Matrix when Neo sees a black cat walk by, and then another black cat walks by just like the first one, causing Trinity to warn him, "A déjà vu is usually a glitch in The Matrix. It happens when they change something." During our trip, we saw no cats and one dog. Time and again, a glitch in the North Korean matrix has you scratching your head. Did I see that? Is that for real? It is, of course, deliberately crepuscular, an exquisitely constructed fog machine. North Korea feels like Kafka, written in an alphabet no one can read. But in the murk, the regime hides its cunning. Kim III's hysterical threat of nuclear war is part of a bleak but clever logic that has kept the dynasty in power long past its two great benefactors, Soviet Russia and Communist China, are dead and gone, or mutated beyond all recognition. The madness shines so bright, it's hard to make out the survivalist logic lurking in the dark. Go see Kim Il-sung, the great leader, the son of the nation, the iron, all-victorious general, the marshal of the mighty republic, the eternal president, is the subject of total love from his nation of 23 million people, or is it 3 million less, and grants them an audience every day of the year. Accessible, yes, but you can't talk to the nation's head of state because Kim I has not been alive these past 19 years. This makes the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea the world's only necrocracy, that is, government by zombie. The living dead god lies in warmth and light in a glass box, a waxwork. The hideous goiter or growth the size of a grapefruit on his neck, so artfully airbrushed out of all photographs in later life, has been in death surgically removed. But be wary of mocking the zombie god too much. In 1945, this thing in the glass box created the most successful tyranny in modern times, a hereditary gangsterism whose lock on power is still strong. In life, Kim Il-sung was a thug, hand-picked by Stalin's gang to take over the half-nation which emerged from Japanese occupation in the wake of the Second World War. In 1950, Kim won, convinced that the people of the South would flock to his banner, started the Korean Civil War, in which around 3 million died. 3 years later, the boundaries of his state were back to where they had been when he started the killing. At the Demilitarized Zone, or DMZ, the colonel in charge told us that the Americans had started the war, a lie so big every North Korean appears to believe it. Kim the First created a personality cult that has brainwashed his people for three generations, and a gulag system for anyone who questions that brainwashing. In Pyongyang's Kumsusan Memorial Palace, our minders, good people, zombie master, made it clear that we must bow to Kim the First, and we did, three times. In a second chamber, the great leader's son, the deer leader, lies in a second glass box. The story goes that the son had the father murdered after a bitter row in which the ailing and flatulent old man finally woke up to the starvation afflicting his people. Funnily enough, they whisper, all the doctors and security agents attending the dying father of the nation died mysteriously or vanished into the gulag. True? False? Who knows? The best book about North Korea, someone said, was written in 1592, and it is called Richard III. Kim Jong-il in death still looks like Bad Elvis. His image to the rest of the world was nailed by South Park's brilliant puppet show film Team America, in which he sings, "I'm so ronery, so ronery, so ronery and sadry arone." I dared to sing that in North Korea while no one was listening, and even so it scared the pants off me. The puppet masters appear to have got the roneriness wrong. Kim, too, reportedly pleasured a human bed of hand-picked North Korean beauties, and when he got bored with them, busty whores from Sweden and Bavaria were flown in for his entertainment. For a long time, the West wondered whether he was a monosyllabic half-wit with only one sentence ever uttered in public, "Glory to the people's heroic military." But the real man was smarter than that. Defectors report that K2 was a sly, thoughtful Bond villain without the white pussycat, a man of some charm and a self-deprecating wit. At one of his lavish parties for the elite, he told the beautiful South Korean actress whom he'd had kidnapped, Che Eun-hee, "I'm as small as a midget's turd, aren't I?" When a group of dancing girls started screaming, "Long live the great leader," Kim, too, told Che's husband, the South Korean film director, Shin Sung-ok, also kidnapped, "All that is bogus. It's just a pretense." He could say that, but no one else would dare. And how can you satirize this? That during the 1990s, Kim Jong-il presided over a man-made famine in which as many as 3 million people died. Zeros dull the mind. A North Korean defector told me the story of why he got out. The decision was forced on him, he said, after his 3-year-old niece, at the height of the famine, gorged herself on dried corn, and then her stomach burst. They call the famine the Arduous March. Orwell's great insight into the totalitarian mindset was to point out how Big Brother took over language and rendered it his servant, and that people with free minds had to push back against this insidious linguistic trick. North Korean newspeak may call the march arduous, but it was also wholly unnecessary, an indictment of the regime's failure to feed its own people. This malfunction is even more dark when you consider that just on the other side of the DMZ lies one of the most successful societies on Earth. South Korea is rich and, these days, democratically handsome. It has its own troubles, too. South Korea has one of the highest suicide rates in the world, with it being the most common cause of death for those under 40. Part of North Korea's tragedy is that it cannot evolve into a tyranny less harsh. All it can do is stay the same or die and be swallowed up by its southern twin, which is, according to some estimates, around 38 times richer, its citizens on average 5 inches taller than their northern brothers and sisters. As regime death is not an option for the Kim dynasty and the Pyongyang elite, the nation lurches on, zombie-like, pitiable, blackly comic, and scary in equal measure. The United Nations estimates that 1 in 4 of the country's children is currently suffering from hunger and malnutrition, and 4% are severely malnourished. These figures may well understate the true horror. Faking statistics in a country with no journalism is easy. But even if we take these figures at face value, it's likely several thousand infants and children in the poorest parts of the land, far away from the Pyongyang belt, are starving to death as you read this book. Had we seen them out of our tourist coach, our minders would have said, "No photos." And then there is the suffering of the invisibles in the gulag. The North Korean regime runs a system of concentration camps in the burning cold of the mountains in which the best estimate is 1 million people have died over the 3 generations the Kim dynasty has been in power. Prisoners inside the gulag suffer unspeakable atrocities, according to a preliminary report by the United Nations Commission of Inquiry, COI, into human rights in the DPRK. North Korea blanked an invitation to take part, but once hearings in Seoul began, the DPRK's official news agency, KCNA, described them as slanderous and labelled the hearing participants as human scum. The head of the inquiry, Australian Judge Michael Kirkby, said, "Truth is a defence against slander. If any of the testimony the COI has heard on political prison camps, international abductions, torture, starvation, intergenerational punishment, and so forth can be shown to be untrue, the Commission invites the Democratic People's Republic of Korea to produce evidence to that effect. An ounce of evidence is worth far more than many pounds of insults and baseless attacks." So far, however, the evidence that the COI has heard has largely pointed in one direction, and evidence to the contrary is lacking. Do the maths. 3 million dead in the war Kim Il-sung started, add 3 million dead from the famine under Kim Jong-il, add 1 million dead in the gulag and other fatal consequences of political and economic oppression, and that equals 7 million people. Kill 7 million people and you would think everyone in North Korea lives in gibbering fear. But Zombie and Sons are adored. People are happy, joking, witty, full of fun. I've been to a dozen or so dictatorships, more often than not undercover. Communist Romania, Czechoslovakia, Albania, Iran, Iraq under Saddam, Libya under Gaddafi, Syria, Chechnya, Zimbabwe, Serbia under Milosevic, Cuba, Belarus, and North Korea. The latter was the tyranny in which I felt the least sense of personal threat. You can get mugged in Cuba. Ordinary tyrants demand devotion. In North Korea, the devotion comes pre-programmed. Our minders suggested we bow to Kim Jong-il too, and we did, 3 times. On the way out of the mausoleum, 2 women were weeping. Nothing compared to the mass mourning which took place after he was announced dead in 2011. Watch it on YouTube. It is a terrifying exhibition of mass grief for a man who must be judged by rational minds as a monster. Do they mean it? Or is this mass fakery in the 21st century? The regime began with Kim Il-sung, a streetwise guerrilla fighter gifted a state by Stalin's generals. Japanese occupation had been a great national insult, and for many in the north it was good to have a Korean ruler, however authoritarian. The bloodshed of the Civil War followed, after which peace was a blessing. That Kim Il-sung started the war, no one in North Korea can say. In the mid-1950s, as de-Stalinization began to pick up speed in the communist world, North Korea galloped off in the opposite direction. Kim I's propagandists first developed a powerful and vicious national Stalinism. This mutated into Juche-ism, home-baked Jabberwocky, plus a Brobdingnagian cult of personality. As the old man's powers weakened, his son, Kim Jong-il, built up the Juche cult, re-baptizing it Kim Il-sungism. Bits of national Stalinism, Juche-ism and Kim Il-sungism are all spouted by the regime when it suits, but the real belief system of the DPRK, the one aggressively fired at its people through television, propaganda posters, the radio and loudspeakers dotted across the nation, is that old black magic, racial purity. There is a subtle difference from Nazi ideology proper. The Koreans of the North are not a master race who must overlord other races, but pure children who must be protected by the leaders, great, dear, and fat. Sorry, young. Like Hitler's Third Reich, the regime is depressingly popular with masses of North Koreans. They are joyfully enthralled to a political religion. The slavishness of its adherents reminds one of America's death cults, but in North Korea, they don't have Kool-Aid. They have nuclear bombs. The regime's race cult chimes with popular but dark tropes in Korean history. The Nazi-style ideology equates racial purity with human goodness. The impure have no right to life, which is why the evidence suggesting that the regime commits infanticide is profoundly disturbing. The UN Human Rights Inquiry reported, "A North Korean woman testified how she witnessed a female prisoner forced to drown her own baby in a bucket. In my 8 days in North Korea, I saw two people who were disabled, and they were both adults. In Africa and Asia and Latin America, you see crippled beggars all the livelong day. The absence of any North Korean disabled babies, infants, or children points toward the following deduction, that the state kills them." Under Kim III, it has been goodbye to the last echoes of communism. In the spring of 2012, giant pictures of Marx and Lenin adorned a building on Kim Il-sung Square. On our trip, 1 year on, Carl and Vlad had vanished. Kim Jong-un is now the third generation Kim to lead the dark state. At 30 years of age, he is a fat young man in a very thin nation. He was educated in a fancy school in Switzerland, so he knows the truth about North Korea, even if no one else does. Footage shown on North Korean television shows him visiting a rocky beach on a gunboat. Soldiers crowd around. Kim III retreats to the gunboat, which slowly backs away from the beach. The soldiers plunge into the freezing sea in a state of religious ecstasy. It is beyond bonkers. On the day Kim III threatened to use his nukes in a thermonuclear war against the United States, we visited the Demilitarized Zone, or the DMZ, or the Z, where the two halves of Korea meet. The colonel in charge said, "Don't worry about it," and patted me on the back. We drove back to Pyongyang and rocked up at a karaoke bar where our minder, Mr. Joe, sang My Way. Thermonuclear regrets? Too few to mention. Was this talk of Armageddon for real, or a shadow game directed at Kim III's own people to make them line up behind him? The government of North Korea tells big lies about killing and famine and power, but the regime cannot lie about the darkness. Salute, reader, the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. In space, there is freedom of movement and freedom of speech, two things not available in the Kim's utopia. The iconic image of North Korea taken from deep space was captured in 2011 by a satellite launched by NASA and NOAA, the American equivalent of the Met Office. The satellite boasts an instrument called the Visible Infrared Imaging Radiometer Suite, which you can think of as a very sensitive digital camera producing images of the light emitted by human activity. This gives you the view you might get if you peeked out of the window of the International Space Station around 500 miles up. The weather satellite looks down on the face of the Earth and shows the world at night. the great cities, sparkling with light, New York, London, Moscow, Beijing, Seoul. The capital of North Korea, Pyongyang, emits a feeble glowworm, but the rest of the country lies in darkness so deep you could easily make the mistake of thinking that this land does not exist. And about the truth of the darkness, Kim III can do nothing. In this book are the stories of witnesses to this dark state, among them seven defectors from the North, an IRA man from West Belfast who spent 2 months in North Korea learning to make bombs, Ceausescu's translator, an American soldier who ran away to the North and 40 years later managed to get out, an Italian senator, an Italian chef, two translators who endured cruel Christs of pus in the Gulag, and a sculptress who vanished from Italy and died unknown to her family 2 decades later in Pyongyang. But locked inside their dictatorship, the people of North Korea do not know how dark their government is. Brainwashing, according to the world's great authority on the subject, Professor Robert Lifton, an American military psychiatrist who treated U.S. servicemen captured in North Korea, requires constriction of information. The less people know, the more they put up with. From the outside, the less we know, the more our fears grow. The regime tells big lies about itself, about history. To nail its quintessential dishonesty, I went to North Korea for BBC Panorama, posing as a history professor. I told a lie to the dictatorship. I did so because the regime ordinarily bans journalists or minds them so tightly that they see next to nothing. The one exception is Associated Press, which boasts an office in Pyongyang. However, AP Pyongyang has been accused of running chirpy, upbeat stories rather than real news, effectively, to paraphrase Basil Fawlty, of having a tacit policy of don't mention the gulag. AP dispute the argument that they self-censor as erroneous. Going to North Korea undercover sometimes felt like being inside the movie Argo, but readers should be aware of a strange paradox. Although it treats its own people cruelly, the DPRK treats foreign guests with almost comic deference. So long as you do not proselytize Christianity, especially if you are a Korean-American missionary, no harm will come to a foreign tourist. North Korea is not Torremolinos. It is much safer. As a group of students and a fake professor, we were honored guests of the regime. The best, least bad comparison I can think of is traveling around Nazi Germany in 1936 during the Munich Olympics. Michael Breen, Kim Jong-il's biographer, also went undercover to North Korea, pretending to be something other than a journalist. As foreigners, we felt safe. The worst that could happen was that we would be expelled. Nothing happened to him. Nothing happened to us. Inside North Korea, we were accompanied pretty much for every single moment by tourist guides, Mr. Hyun and Miss Jun. By filming inside North Korea without the regime's blessing, we were accused of endangering the guides. We did not, according to Simon Cockrell of Korea Tours, in other words, a critic of our panorama. The guides in the tour shown on the program are fine. They are still working, and I saw them personally when I visited North Korea last week, April 2013. They were not shown saying anything out of the ordinary, and the reporter, other than the raw fact of being a reporter, didn't get up to anything wildly illegal in North Korea. Cockrell, who has visited North Korea 119 times, says that North Korea is safe for foreign tourists. We have run thousands of tours over 20 years, and we have never had anyone detained, questioned, molested, ejected, or arrested. Of President George W. Bush's three axes of evil, Saddam's Iraq, the Ayatollah's Iran, and North Korea, the latter is by far and away the safest to visit, but also the worst place to live in. Sergeant Charles Robert Jenkins of the U.S. Army defected to North Korea in 1965. Thanks to extraordinary luck and the power of love, he got out after 40 years inside what he calls a giant, demented prison. He is right, but prisons have guards, not guides. Behind the question, "Did you endanger the guides?" lies an assumption that North Korea is a normal place to visit. North Korea is not normal. No ordinary person is free to move around inside the country. No ordinary person can leave it, ever. No free speech. No rule of law. No parliament worthy of the name. Brainwashing for three generations. The guides work hard to present as normal a picture of North Korea as possible, to push back against the raising of difficult questions. The regime subtly pressures foreign visitors to comply with its world view. Obey the guides or they will suffer. That is the message. That pressure is effective. But should it be complied with? The guides, of course, are real flesh and blood people. So too are the 100,000 political prisoners in the gulag. But they are invisible. By not endangering the guides, is it possible that you are doing a greater disservice to the invisible victims of the regime? When our guides showed us nonsense, for example, a hospital with patients but only in the morning, I mentally imagined the 100,000 or so souls in the gulag cheering us on. But those cheers, and even more their screams, are silent to us. Just because we cannot see or hear them does not mean they do not exist, as Chapter 19, The Gulag Circus, sets out. The human factor kicks in, as ever. Our guards or minders were sweet people, but also agents of a dark regime. Richard Lloyd Parry of The Times put it bluntly, "They are privileged, well-educated, and by North Korean standards, well-informed servants of a totalitarian dictatorship. As human beings, they are as various as the rest of us, but putting aside their friendliness, curiosity, or the lack of it, their job is to lie, bamboozle, and obfuscate." The people invited to come to North Korea were LSE students and alumni, but it wasn't an LSE trip. The students were told twice that a journalist was coming, and they were warned that there was a risk of arrest, detention, and the possibility they might not be able to go on a return trip. On the day the group met, the North Koreans carried out a nuclear test. It was all over the news. Anyone who wanted to drop out could have done so. Long before we left London, my name was on the paperwork. Again, from my perspective, there was no intention to deceive the students. We went as part of a tourist trip arranged through the KFA, the Korean Friendship Association, which has been described as being like one of the more improbable cults. The KFA's president is Alejandro Cao de Benos, or to use his Korean honorific, Zosun Il, which means Korea is one. The Spanish IT consultant, who likes dressing up in North Korean uniform, has been criticized by The Independent as an ideological brown-noser. The newspaper cited anonymous critics, describing him as the perfect example of the useful idiot. Another said, "In my view, he's a narcissist, and he loves the power and control he has over there. He does have real influence, people are frightened of him, and he likes that power. I think his primary motivation is that he's special there." A third said, "You can't possibly believe that stuff if you've been there. To come back and tell North Korean people that everything they hear is correct, that the rest of the world is evil, out to cut each other's throats, that war and oppression is everywhere, he perpetuates that. He's not forced to. He does that for personal gain and power and prestige. It's horrible." In his defense, Cao de Benos told The Independent, "I will take this as a type of jealousy from people who have no goals in their life. I have lived a life of big things. I didn't want to dedicate my life to be a slave in the capitalist system. My dream was to be a part of the revolution. Once our party was back from Pyongyang, safe and sound, I went on the BBC World News and said the regime was mad and sad and bad and silly all at the same time. The North Koreans saw my interview, and Cao De-Benos, writing as the special delegate for the Committee for Cultural Relations with Foreign Countries of the DPRK, fired back, "I am now in communication with LSE representatives. To obtain a visa without declaring the real purpose of the visit is against the law. We will ignore this incident if Mr. Sweeney stops his journalistic activities regarding the LSE-DPRK visit. Otherwise, if the related program is broadcasted, I would be left with no choice but to expose all the real story and data. And the only one to blame for this will be Mr. Sweeney. You decide." Cao De-Benos made good on his threat. The London School of Economics, my old university, was supplied with the information we'd given to the North Korean embassy in Beijing. The LSE's director, Craig Colquhoun, had been in Beijing at the same time that we were. These days, my old university gets money from China in return for teaching Chinese senior government officials. The LSE went public with North Korea's information on us, condemned what we had done, and called for the program not to be broadcast. The BBC stood firm, and our documentary was aired. A row started, which has yet to be resolved. The story splashed in the Times, and there were questions in Parliament. On Twitter, I was compared to Jimmy Savile and to Saif Gaddafi, someone who really has a doctorate from the LSE. Getting in and out of the world's most secretive dictatorship is not easy. One solution is not to bother. But it is important that journalists try to shed light on dark places where freedom of thought is snuffed out. One of the great North Korea watchers, Andrei Lankov, has noted, "No foreigner is allowed to do independent research in Korean libraries, let alone archives. Indeed, typically a foreign visitor is simply denied access to the library catalogues." Before transmission, a few students were worried about appearing in our film. We blobbed them out. We did not mention the LSE, nor did we ever intend to. But then, of course, a very public row blew up with arguments on both sides. The BBC Trust is examining complaints about our panorama. For that reason, now is not the time and place to discuss these issues further. More than 6 million viewers watched our panorama, North Korea Undercover. That's 1 in 10 people in Britain. They saw the ordinary lies the regime told us and listened to defectors' testimony the regime does not want heard. It was broadcast on the 15th of April, the holiest day in the North Korean calendar, it being Kim Il-sung's birthday, timing which left one of our defector contributors gurgling with joy. North Korea remains the most rigidly controlled nation on Earth, but some of the technological marvels of the 21st century are beginning to melt the ice pack. 2 million people have mobile phones, but they can only use them for internal calls. At the DMZ, one of the students I was travelling with switched on his iPhone and picked up a signal from phone masts just across the border in South Korea. He tweeted, "At the DMZ, hashtag just chillin." I switched on and also picked up a signal. If we could do that, so could a North Korean using a smuggled Chinese mobile phone. The regime's icy grip on information is beginning to crack. Yet, the Kim dynasty remains in place almost a quarter of a century after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Perhaps the greatest mystery of this dark nation is, why haven't the people overthrown the tyranny? Barbara Demick's brilliant, harrowing study of the famine in the 1990s is called Nothing to Envy. But a quick survey of the states who have a stake in what happens in North Korea, South Korea, China, Japan, and the United States could be summarized as nothing to gain. South Korea may dislike the tyranny, but does it really want to deal with 20-odd million half-starved and miserably poor compatriots? Does China want a U.S. ally creeping right up to its border? Does Japan want a bigger, stronger all-Korea competitor? Does the United States and the rest of the world want a terrifying transition when the nuclear-armed tyranny falls and something different takes its place? Or is stasis the lesser evil? In 1987, President Reagan went to West Berlin and told the Soviet leader, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." Nothing like that bold command is being said today. The threat of Armageddon cannot be lightly dismissed. Professor Brian Myers, an expert on North Korean ideology, told me, "We may see a thermonuclear war. I'm not sure it's the North Koreans' plan to unleash that kind of a thing, but it might come to that as a result of a disastrous miscalculation." The counterargument is that in the darkness of North Korea, we may be missing something darker yet. That fear of change, and in particular, an overhyped fear of thermonuclear war, a war in which Kim Jong-un must know he would lose very badly, very quickly, is obscuring the reality of a nation suffering immense misery. The tyrant's threat is masking his people's agony. Everything here represents my own views and not those of the BBC. If you believe the press cuttings, there are times when I must seem to my colleagues a random trouble generator. I apologize to them and to the great British public who pay my wages. But to do difficult journalism, maybe you have to be a member of the awkward squad. But I'm a firm believer of shining light in dark places. I've written books about four states of mind lock, not essentially dissimilar to North Korea. Ceausescu's Romania, which I visited in 1985 and then in 1989 when the leader's plans for Christmas ended in a firing squad. Saddam's Iraq, Lukashenko's Belarus, and the Church of Scientology, terrifying and creepy in 2007, and at the time of writing in 2013, less so. To understand what is going on in North Korea now, it helps that Romanian communists, Ba'athist Iraqis, and many Scientologists once assured me with grave solemnity of their undying loyalty to the powers that be, only for them to reveal a few years later that they had been brainwashed. Regimes fall, statues get smashed, the concrete of the mind crumbles to dust. Outside No Animal Farm, there was a giant statue to Kim I, surrounded by happy peasants loaded with bushels of corn. Our minders suggested we bow the seventh time that day, and we did. 2 weeks later in South Korea, I asked a defector and the leader of a brave organization with a Monty Python-esque name, the North Korean People's Liberation Front, if he had ever seen any graffiti. He said no at first, but then he grew animated, remembering seeing one graffito in his whole time in the North. It was in a town in the northeast of the country, on the wall of a university hospital, and at 6 o'clock in the morning. Someone had scrawled, "Down with Kim Jong-il." The defector drew the ideograms in my notebook, showing how the phrase in Korean is written, "Kim Jong-il, down with," and that the name was clear and bold, and the last part hurried, as if it had been dashed out. Half an hour later, a crowd of about 30 had gathered, the defector said. Then the police arrived and painted it out. One day I shall return to North Korea. The regime is not as strong as it looks. One day the statues of the two mass murderers will come crashing down. I will find that graffito artist, and I shall bow before him or her. And this time I shall mean it. Chapter 1. In the Land of the Plastic Toad. Of the five most creepy buildings in the world, the squat grey toad of the KGB FSB head office in Lubyanka Square, Moscow, the alien spaceship-like Ryugyong Hotel in Pyongyang, the Church of Scientology's blue concrete angel on L. Ron Hubbard Way in L.A., Enver Hoxha's marble pyramid mausoleum in Tirana, Albania, and the Pyongyang Planetarium, the latter is the creepiest. A giant disco ball of a Saturn lookalike with ferro-concrete ring, it stands proud on the plain en route between the airport's cattle shed arrivals hall and the big zombie Pyongyang itself, visible from the main road through a sickly copse. There's something of a coelacanth about the futurology of the recent past, back then when men wore big specs and women had big hair. The Pyongyang Saturn was supposed to project just what an essential part of the future the Democratic People's Republic of Korea would be, and the present-day reality, briefly glimpsed through the windows of our coach, the planet's surface is decorated with mirror squares so that you half expect to see John Travolta in white suit strut his stuff beneath it. But the Bee Gees aren't big in North Korea, and the mirrors have long since lost their shine. Across the Pyongyang basin, a high mist or low cloud clung to the surface of the earth, nothing like as acrid as the pollution in Beijing, but gloomy nevertheless, and the effect of the great planet not shining was of a future gone to the grave. You feel like a time traveller, or that you are locked inside the set of a bad science fiction movie, one that goes on for 45,000 square miles. The obverse is also true for North Koreans making the opposite journey, leaving their world and travelling through the looking glass to encounter what feels like another planet. I felt like a frog that had just come out of its pit, from which it had contemplated the circle of sky outlined by the rim and taken it for the whole of the world. I had passed through to the other side of the mirror, writes the defector Hyuk Kang in his book, This is Paradise. The bad sci-fi trope echoes in travellers' tales from North Korea like an over-familiar nightmare. The wonderful Italian writer Tiziano Terzani first came to North Korea in 1980. He wrote that the plane that twice a week brings the rare travellers from Beijing to Pyongyang is